This is KSQD Santa Cruz, KSQT Prunedale, KSQD 89.5, 89.7, 90.7 FM, or online at ksqd.org. From Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Thanks so much for joining me. Our guest today is Alexa Morris, co-author of a deeply moving new memoir, The Courtyard, a very different Holocaust memoir that tells the survival story of her father-in-law, Benjamin Parkett. Alexa Morris, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you, Gary. It's a pleasure to be here.
It was a wonderful and moving book, and, you know, like everybody, I have read other Holocaust memoirs, and you know, sort of like too many Holocaust memoirs. Nobody wants to read a Holocaust memoir, but on the other hand, this one is really a marvelous book that I think everybody would enjoy. It's beautifully written. It's very cinematic, and as I said, unusual and different. So tell me, how did this book come about? You're the co-author with your father-in-law?
That is correct. I had never tried to write a book before. I grew up an avid reader and was always wanting to try, but was a little bit nervous and shy about it. But when I got together with my now wife, and she introduced me to her father, my father-in-law, and he shared the story with me. He also shared that he had wanted to write it as a book and that he had started in fits and starts, but had not been able to complete it. So my partner, Karen, as she said, well, I know you've always wanted to write a book. Here's a story that needs to be told. You two should work together. And so we did.
So I want to know the logistics of that before we get into the whole story. So you discovered that your father-in-law had this story to tell and that he had tried to write it. And so did you take what he had written? Did you sit down with him with a tape recorder? How did you get the story out of him?
That's a great question. I didn't really take what he had. I mean, he had only written one, the first chapter. What I did is I did sit down and interview him time and time again with a tape recorder and just also took notes. I interviewed his brother, who was still alive at the time, his older brother. And then I started trying to piece together how it might come together as a book. And when I would write something and say, is this match your recollection? Because sometimes I would have to add details about the place that I had just reconstructed through history, or he would say, no, that's not quite right. Or yes, that is. And then I would continue to refine it. So it was a constant back and forth, me taking a huge, you know, data dump of his memories and recollections, and then trying to stitch them together into what became the book.
Well, is he still alive?
He is. He's 92. He'll be 93 this August.
That's wonderful. So you've never written before. How long have you been working on this?
Oh, this has been a really long, this has been quite a labor of love. It's been 10 years or more, honestly. I mean, a lot of that was because I was raising a family and working full time. And so I would only carve out small pockets of time over the years. And I wasn't, to be honest, anybody who's ever tried to write a book, you have to figure out exactly how you're going to do it. I mean, I had never done that before. So it just took a while to figure out how to tell the story. And then there was a lot of research involved because anybody who reads it will see that there's a lot of historical context put in the various chapters so that hopefully the reader gets a sense of what was actually going on in the outside world, outside of this family's experience. And that took me a lot of time just to learn about World War II, because I really didn't know that much about it, honestly.
Right. So so the story that you tell, which is Benjamin Parkett's story, he was born in France, although his family was from Eastern Europe, from Poland, right?
Yes, that's correct.
And when the war comes, when the Germans invade France, they go into hiding for the duration of the war.
Yes. Not immediately, of course, because it took a while. The Germans, I think they took Paris in June of 1940, and it wasn't until July of 1942 that the family actually went into hiding because, as they had done in other areas that they had conquered, they slowly implemented the anti-Semitic legislation and the restrictions until gradually it became less and less tenable to be a Jew in whatever occupied country you were in. And then eventually the roundups began, and that is when the family went into hiding, just before the infamous Veldiv roundup.
The thing that was that struck me as I was reading The Courtyard, Alexa Morris, the America right now is in a kind of a perilous state, I believe, and it seems things seem really ominous, and it's a hard time to be Jewish or to be gay, I would imagine. And when I read about the times that are so well described in The Courtyard, I thought, well, you know, it could be a lot worse. But at the same time, much of the scary part of it feels really scarily familiar. And so I'm wondering if those feelings were part of what drove you to complete the book.
Absolutely. I mean, it's heartbreaking to me that Ben, who is, as I said, 92, that his life will be bookended by these periods of anti-Semitism. I mean, his a child, he experienced it, and it obviously he had to go in hiding. I really hope that's not where we're going now, but to see in one lifetime, to see the world change and come around to this again is pretty heartbreaking and scary. To watch my partner, who used to wear her Star of David necklace around her neck, take it off and put it in a drawer because it makes her nervous, especially when she's traveling. Those themes were very much in my mind as I was writing the book.
And, you know, we heard about in your book the citizenship rights of Jews being rescinded, taken away from them, and laws passed against them where just kind of normal everyday activity became illegal so that they could criminalize them and arrest them. And in your lifetime, you mentioned that you were married to a woman, and those kinds of rights, which, you know, have been around for a few years now, are slowly, maybe not so slowly, being eroded. I mean, how are you feeling?
I mean, it makes me really nervous. Honestly, we live in California. We live in a bubble of some, you know, to some degree. But honestly, we have considered when will we leave? You know, you want to fight and you want to stay. And this is our home. This is our country. And we want to belong and we feel like we belong. But also, I always, because of Ben's story, you know, the families that left France or left places that were occupied by the Nazis early, they were safe if they went somewhere else. And I think, what is that line for us? To be honest, when Roe v. Wade was revoked, you know, that was a line that I didn't think. I thought, when this is a line that is a real warning to us, and yet the warnings keep coming, and it is a scary thing because you really feel what must have been the pull. And that the Parquettes felt like, well, but it's going to be okay. It's not going to get worse than this, you know. And you can continue to feel that way. Convince
right.
yourself.
Yeah. Well, when I was a kid growing up, I'm Jewish, and I was born 10 years after the end of the war. And there was a lot of, you know, we heard a lot of stories, and we're told never again, and all this stuff. And I always wondered, why did Jews stay there? Why didn't they leave? And now that I have a home and a place that I love, you know, the idea of leaving is pretty foreign to me. But I was recently in London. I went to the Imperial War Museum, where the Holocaust is laid out in a sort of a step-by-step view. You can really see, and they use all kinds of visuals to show you how the diaspora of the Jews from the Pale moved to various places in Europe because it was safe, and then those places became unsafe. And then you get to this thing in 1938 where a lot of Jews said, okay, it's time to leave, but they couldn't leave by then. It was already too late for them to leave.
That is right.
So I know it's as I'm reading your book, these are some of the scary thoughts that are going through my mind. And I'm thinking, well, that's probably why she wrote this. She wants to make me miserable. That's why she wrote it.
No, definitely not. But it is something to keep in mind. I mean, you know, I think the Parquettes partially they didn't leave because they didn't actually have the financial resources to go anywhere. You know, they were a working class family living in a two-room apartment off a courtyard, and Ben's father was a varnisher, so they had already immigrated once. Where were they going to go? You know, their home was already now at this point ruled by Nazis, and all of their relatives were unfortunately already in the Warsaw Ghetto, or worse. So they didn't really know where to go, nor did they have the resources. But I think a lot of people who could leave also choose to stay because it's your home.
Yeah, it's right. Well, these are some of the interesting things that. So then I wonder, when you talk to your father-in-law, first of all, how does he feel about the finished book? Is he proud of it? Is he proud of you?
Oh, yes. I mean, he's really, really happy about it. And I'm very gratified that he's proud of me and just so happy to have this in the hands of his family. That was really the most important thing for him, to have this story, to see that his family that are remaining that are still in Israel, they're reading it, to see his grandchild who read the book at the same age that he was when he was in hiding and did a book report in his class. To see those sorts of things happen, I think it's incredibly gratifying to him. Yes.
So, Alexa Morris, go back again and tell me, at what point did you, in your life, did you realize that your father-in-law had this story? I mean, is that something that you knew right away, or when did you discover it?
I knew it pretty early on that he was a survivor of the Holocaust. I did know that. That was, but I didn't know his complete story. And in fact, nor did his children. I mean, I know more about his experience now than his three children do. I mean, they now know mostly.
Because they've read your book, yeah.
Because they've read it, yes.
And now I know it all too. Yeah.
Yes. Well, that's the goal, right? That the world hears these stories and can be reminded of what happened. But so it just came out over time. He was really ready and eager to share it because he wanted it recorded. I mean, he had been recorded by the project, the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Oral Histories Project that Steven Spielberg sponsored. He was recorded with that. And he's a member of a group in California of Hidden Children, where they tell each other the stories and they get together to speak regularly. But he hadn't done anything more formal than that until we got together.
Yeah. Well, it's a marvelous story, and there's so many details. I mean, so when you say you went over things with him again and again, so you would dig deeper and get more details from him each time?
Yes. I mean, for example, one of the most poignant parts of the story is actually not really about him being in hiding. It's about his friendship with a girl that lived in the courtyard. And she was his first and best friend when he was a young boy. Her name was Titi, and they played together in the courtyard. They played hide and seek. They hid under his parents' bed and shared a pan au chocolat. They walked to school each day, even though they went to separate schools next door and walked home. I mean, that was his best friend. And when he was in hiding, he was separated from her. And he would tell me how he daydreamed about being with her again and playing with her again. He had a specific dream of riding out of the courtyard on a horse with her riding behind him as they sort of waved to the neighbors and went off to an adventure. But then when he was, once again, when he was liberated and he saw her, you know, 2 years had passed because they were in hiding for over 2 years, and her life had moved on and she had become a different girl. And so their friendship was never the same. And when he first told me this story, he told me this very matter-of-factly, like, well, that's just what happens. And I was like, but Ben, that must have been heartbreaking to you. You know, this is the friend that you had dreamed of being reunited with, and you had been stuck sort of ossifying in this warehouse while she was out living her life, and you emerged to find that she's just not the girl that you knew anymore, and she doesn't, you know, she didn't miss you anymore. And over time, that sort of, I think that feeling of quiet childhood heartbreak he opened up more about it. You know, those sorts of things. I think he had tamped down certain memories, but in talking about them more, he was willing to share. Yes, of course, that was heartbreaking.
In the about the author part of you in the book, I know that you're working on a novel now. So did the novelist part of you want to bring those two children together in a more satisfying way? Were you tempted to alter the facts?
Oh, that's a really interesting question. I wasn't tempted to alter the facts only because I think that there is something really powerful and heartbreaking in what was the truth. This is yet another casualty of childhood in having to be in hiding, that he did miss out on these 2 years, that it is, but I didn't want to misrepresent his experience, but by making it more heartbreaking and tragic than it was. But I wanted to uncover if it really was as painful as I suspected it was, you know?
Now, listeners to this program might not remember, but at the beginning of this decade, there was this thing, period of time where we were all locked down. I don't think people have any recollection of it, but it happened. And part of that, part of the COVID, you know, lockdown feels very familiar in your story.
Well, it's interesting that you bring that up, because as we went through the pandemic in our household, and as I mentioned earlier, we're in California and we really took those stay-at-home mandates very seriously.
Yep.
We were isolating at home with our daughter, who was then 12, 13. She was in middle school. And Ben joked to me at the time. He said, well, now you're going to get a little bit of a taste of what I went through. And it really sparked something in my mind when he said that. And I ended up writing actually an essay about it, which is on my website, about comparing our experience with his experience. Mm-hmm. Because while we went through something that was very isolating and very challenging, and it was challenging certainly for our daughter, it was such a pale comparison, you know, it pales in comparison to what he went through, for sure.
Yeah. Although millions of people died during the pandemic.
That is a very valid point. And it was in that way, it was pretty catastrophic.
I mean, I'm curious to know about your daughter, if you don't mind. So, I mean, I teach at Monterey Peninsula College, and my students this semester are students who were in middle school during the pandemic. And I think they're wonderful and I love them, but I think they're missing something in terms of their education, it's a much different kind of education, let's just put it that way, than the one that I had and probably the one that you had. So how is your daughter coping, and where is she in her academic career now?
I know exactly what you're talking about, because I've had conversations with parents and actually with teachers about the impact that that all the kids that had to go through that the isolation really experienced. And I think it stunted a lot of them socially and kind of developmentally in ways that we don't even yet understand. I think I saw that a little bit in her, but honestly, she's a very social kid and she's a very creative kid. She's currently at Emerson College in Boston.
how coincidental, because our friend Lissa Warren, who is the publicist who brought me your book, is a teacher there.
That is correct. And yet that's not even how I got connected to her, but independently, but yes. Yeah. And she's a filmmaker, and she's actually about ready to take a gap year where she's going to travel the world as a part of a program called Beret Scholars. So she's very much living life and experiencing life, and I think she's kind of caught up. But I see this in, and I just feel lucky, because I think that a lot of kids have really struggled to overcome the damage done, honestly, in that period of isolation that we all experienced.
And you can really identify, because of this in the book, The Courtyard, your main character, the teller of the tale, Benjamin Parkett, and his family are all in this very small space. And there's a scene in your book where somebody lives in a 4-bedroom house, and there's five of them, and they feel like their house is too small. And here is this family of five living in this very small space.
Yes, in the warehouse, in a single room, no electricity, a chamber pot, you know, a cup, two mattresses on the floor. The three boys shared a single twin mattress head to toe. So the conditions are really very, very primitive and not something that most of us can relate to.
Yeah. What about the, you know, the physical aspects of that in terms of like bathing and privacy and all that stuff?
Ben doesn't remember privacy being a concern or thinking about it. And I think that some things maybe just got kind of blocked and were not, maybe also not important to a 9 to 11 year old.
Yeah.
But they bathed by heating water on, there was a wood stove in the warehouse. That's how they cooked. They were only allowed to use it during the day because at night it was, it would provoke curiosity, which would be not wanted. So I think that they used a pot and a washcloth and warm water to just sponge bathe, which actually was all Ben had ever done until that point anyway, because their apartment didn't have a bathroom or a kitchen. And the older family members, they went to a bathhouse down the street. And that's, you know, once a week on Wednesdays to actually take a bath. But he was very used to being bathed by a washcloth.
That's one thing about our modern world. I mean, we're very into we're. The old world in the past, it must have smelled really bad.
Yes. Maybe, I know.
They never talk about that in science fiction, but a time traveler going back in time, first thing he would say is, wow, it smells here.
Yes, exactly. Nobody's brushing their teeth either. I mean,
yeah. Wow. It must have been fun for you, even though it's a horrifying story, to time travel in a way and getting inside your father-in-law's head and experiencing it through him.
Absolutely. I mean, it was educational, obviously, to say the least, but really, really fascinating to get a picture of that time period, what it was like to grow up that way. I mean, there's the heartbreaking and scary stuff, but also there was a real magic to his childhood and the freedom that he had and the way the courtyard enveloped him as a child, and the people that lived there were, I think, wonderful people for him to grow up around.
Well, Alexa Morris, I want to ask you about a challenge that must have faced you when you were writing The Courtyard, this Holocaust memoir. We know, because you've already told us, that your father-in-law is still alive, so he did not perish like Anne Frank during World War II. So you have to tell a story in which nothing happens. The crux of the story is that nothing happens, which is wonderful. It's good that nothing happens.
Yes, but you're right.
Yeah. So what kind of a challenge did that face for you as a storyteller?
That was a really big challenge. And I think that's one of the reasons it took me so long to write it, because to figure out what it's a true story, but what the narrative arc was really, when the family just was in hiding for 2 years. And there were moments that were very scary. There were moments where they were almost revealed, obviously, but I think to me, it's a quiet story, but I, you know, hopefully a story well told about what this boy experienced, what this family experienced. And then at the end of the day, it became really a story about what their neighbors did too to protect them during this time, and what we owe our neighbors, and what community is, and what this courtyard was for them, and what we should be doing now, as we look around at this modern world. So yes, that's a strange way of answering your question. Not a lot happened. It's a quiet story, but I think there are messages in there, I hope, that really resonate with readers today.
Well, and let me tell you, readers today, it's a page turner, even though it's a book about nothing, so to speak. But it's not. It's a book about so many things, and it's very well written and very moving. And the book is called The Courtyard, a Memoir, and it was written by Benjamin Parkett and my guest, Alexa Morris. Alexa Morris, thank you so much for spending some time talking to us about it on From the Bookshelf.
Absolutely my pleasure, Gary. It was really a delight to talk to you. Thank you.
Kitty Bruce, who helped preserve the legacy of her father, Lenny Bruce, the countercultural comedian and iconoclast whose stand-up routines in the 1950s and 60s pushed hard against the boundaries of the First Amendment, died on May 13th, the age of 70. Kitty was a friend and dedicated her life not only to her father's legacy, but to supporting recovering addicts. A few years ago, on the occasion of a new printing of her father's autobiography, we had this conversation. It's been 50 years since the death of comedian Lenny Bruce, and he was more than a stand-up comedian. He was an iconoclast who blazed the trail for Richard Pryor and George Carlin and generations of comic minds to follow. He was persecuted for challenging the powers that be. He left behind a wealth of recordings and an amazing book, originally serialized in Playboy magazine and now reprinted for a new generation. The book is How to Talk Dirty and Influence People, and its republication is the occasion for a visit from my guest this week, Kitty Bruce, Lenny Bruce's daughter. Kitty Bruce, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
So you were just telling me that you just came back from Brandeis. Tell us what that's all about.
Okay. I was trying to get my father's autobiography republished for at least, I would say, 7 years. And apparently there just wasn't any interest because it had been out for so very long. And only a couple were in print, I think, and they were Simon and Schuster. So finally, we get a book deal. And I was very happy because I wanted to introduce my father to a new generation. I didn't want his work to be forgotten. For somebody who doesn't know Lenny Bruce or never heard him, it's still, with all that, it's really a good read.
It really is a fabulous book.
It is. I mean, okay, so I went up to Brandeis, and there was a 2-day symposium. Lewis Black did some entertaining, and he's funny. Oh, my God, is he funny. And there was symposiums, one right after the other, on everything from humor to comedy and the Constitution. It was amazing that all these people, we had people come from Japan, from Paris, and just to learn and discuss about Lenny Bruce. And it really, Gary, it humbled me. I was floored. I looked around and I looked at all these people that paid to come to this conference to look at the exhibit.
What kinds of things would they see there?
Well, I had everything up in my attic, and which is not a good place for it.
Uh-huh.
And quick story, a man from Paris called me, and he said, my name is Steve Krayev, and I've done my PhD on Lenny Bruce, and I would like to present it to you. And now I'm thinking to myself, who does their PhD on Lenny Bruce? So he comes from Paris, he gets on a plane, and lands in New York, then he takes a 3.5-hour bus ride to the town in which I live. And he walks in, and he had not one, but two big, they look like two yellow pages, one on top of the other.
Hmm.
And it was his PhD on Lenny Bruce, and he brought two of them. And he said that in case, you know, I wanted a copy. And it was all in French. And they were so massive, I wanted to see how much they weighed. So I put them on a scale, and they weighed 5 pounds apiece. So this young man had really delved into my father's work, his thoughts, everything. So he comes to my house, and I'm showing him pictures and letters and different things of my father's, and he said, you know, you should really look into having this preserved. And I said, I don't know. He said, call up Hugh Hefner. And I said, I'm not going to call Hugh Hefner and ask him to do, you know, just don't. And he says, well, I think they should go to Brandeis. And I said, why Brandeis? And he said, because it's the type of university that they didn't, it was one of the reasons it was so important was that Jews, after the war, were not being accepted into Ivy League schools. And they had such high test scores that they were being discriminated against because of their religious and or their affiliation. So Albert Einstein and a couple other great minds got together and made this university happen. And Justice Brandeis, he was very, very old when he passed, but he was a very smart and scholarly man. So everything is there. It's 10 linear feet.
Wow.
You
had that in your attic?
Yeah.
You must have a big attic.
Yeah. Well, my attic, it's just ridiculous. I call myself the keeper of the dead people things because I have my mother in one corner, my grandmother in another corner, my grandfather's second wife, my dad, my late husband. So there's a lot of stuff up there.
Yeah.
And so I'm just thrilled that.
Well, so tell me, what would I see if I was looking there at Brandeis? What's in this 10 linear feet?
Okay, well, from the exhibit, if I shut my eyes, you'd walk in and you'd see pictures, a lot of photographs that are on the wall. There's different personal letters that are encased in glass. There is, God, I don't even know how many hundreds of hours of tapes that the Grammy Foundation gave Brandeis a grant, and they were able to take all the reel-to-reels and put them on digital so you could listen. There's court transcripts. I mean, it's massive, Gary.
Well,
massive.
That's so great.
Oh, I'm so thrilled that I just am so thrilled. I'm in awe, in absolute awe.
So now you've got this wonderful archive there. The book has been republished. A couple of years ago, I know you did this other wonderful thing, the Let the Buyer Beware that you co-produced with Shout Factory. And it has, I think, what, 6 discs of incredible
stuff.
Gary?
Yeah? Your volume is going away.
Oh, I'm sorry. Can you hear me now?
Yeah, but I'd crank it a little bit.
Okay.
Yeah, okay.
All right. I was talking about this box set that you did, that you co-produced at Shout. It was a 6-disc mm-hmm. thing. So is there still a lot left that hasn't come out?
That collection came from, my idea was that I wanted people to know what made Lenny Bruce tick. And I still haven't figured it out. And the premise of the CDs was to start from the very beginning of his life and his career and take it all the way until the day he died, which was on tape. He loved to tape, constantly taping things. And I forgot what I was going to say.
We're just talking about this box set. So did he actually tape himself on the day that he died, you're saying?
There was tapes of it, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. It's just massive. Is there more? Absolutely. Is it being housed? Absolutely. Okay. The collection is open for researchers. There were scholars, law students, professors, It's there to and can be used for so many different things. So many. the English language, the use of the English language, the gross misuse of power in the government.
Yeah.
Especially, I was reading a chapter out of How to Talk Dirty and Influence People, and, you know, you have to remember that he was being arrested, pulled off stage and arrested for talking. And the excuse was obscenity. And he talks about this in the book very clearly. And so the excuse was obscenity, but the real reason was the content. He shook up people's core belief systems. And when you start playing around with beliefs, what somebody holds dear to their heart, mom, apple pie, religion, and the flag, you start playing with that, and there's going to be an issue.
It's kind of interesting that the words that he was arrested for saying are words that pretty much every middle school student now says, you know, pretty much every day. But a lot of the words that he used that no one cared about then, now people would be offended by.
You know, yes, you're right. It was there was a bit called "Are There Any Niggers Here Tonight?" And my dad did a routine on to take you back when he was in the Second World War. He got tight with a guy from, I think, Haiti. And there was black blood being spilt on those shores. There was white blood, yellow blood, blood's blood. So my dad comes back to the United States, goes in to get a cup of coffee, and there's a counter, but the same people that fought for our country weren't allowed to have a cup of coffee and sit together in a restaurant. And so he was absolutely outraged. And so he did this bit, "Are There Any Niggers Here Tonight?" Because the premise of the bit was, if the word was said so many times that eventually it would lose its power. And the reason he wanted to do this is because he didn't want a young black child coming home crying because somebody called him a nigger. Okay? Back then, people were horrified. This is before all this politically correct got corrected and uncorrected. You know, and to be perfectly frank, I don't think that, I think that people of color reserve the right to be able to say what they want and how they want to say it, but I do not believe that that it's everybody thinks that that language is okay to be degrading. It's not okay. It's definitely not okay. But you're right. Some of those things could be offensive if that you're not looking for where he was coming from, and it's difficult because it's 50 years later, Gary.
Right. Well, you know, did he start out, Kitty Bruce, did he start out to make waves, or did it just happen? I mean, he was just, at first, a comedian who told jokes, right?
He wasn't a ha-ha joke teller, but he certainly wasn't the man that he evolved into. He started out doing impressions and just, you know, lightweight. And then he started talking a little bit more personally. And my father had a persona that he would seduce the audience. He was just seductive. You could, and you felt that you were the most important person in the room when he looked at you or when you were listening to him. And you got a sense of, you know what? I matter. Because in the stretch of things, Gary, people just want to feel as though they're being heard and that they matter. So his evolvement came, a lot of it had to do with Hugh Hefner. Hef had a show called Playboy After Dark, and my father and Hugh Hefner were under attack from the government, constantly getting thrown, you know, arrested, pulled into court for many, many things, and then the case would be overturned. But I just think that his whole evolving just happened because it was, he saw things and heard things that he didn't connect with and felt were hypocritical.
Well, when he took on organized religion, you know, that he must have known that, you know, there would be fallout from that, right?
Yeah, well, especially, dig where, you know where he started off with that?
Where?
In Chicago. Are you kidding me? You don't go to Chicago, okay, where at that time, you know, like 90% of everybody is an Italian Catholic. Or Irish Catholic. It's just religion, period. And he wasn't too thrilled with the Jewish religion either, of which he was a Jew. You know, and he was told that he was going to have a bar mitzvah, and he was very excited. And my grandma came home and said, Lenny, we're not going to have a bar mitzvah. And he was very disappointed. And he said, why? And she told him, well, it was because we didn't have the money, that the rabbi wanted $200.
Really?
Yeah, and that, I think, started a... That's when I think that his hard-on for religion started. And plus, it was just so two-sided, because there was all this wealth and gold and everything just very opulent and wonderful, and yet at the same time, you know, he'd go to different parts of the Bronx or Brooklyn, and there's nine people living in, you know, two rooms. So he felt that there was something wrong with that picture, you know. But regardless of anybody's views, the right should never be taken from a person. We need to be able to speak. That's how we're a free society. And to be very frank with you, things really haven't changed that much, Gary.
No.
There's still racism. The whole thing, it's the same song, but just with different faces.
Yeah.
The news that we watch is already all pre-blended. It's all put out just, you know, what we are told to hear. And I'm not some nut with a tinfoil hat sitting in the middle of nowhere waiting for the mothership to come. You know, it's there's racism, there's still war, there's still big carrying on about homosexuality. A lot of this stuff just, it hasn't changed. And except for the fact that we have the media and social media, so the ability to get the information comes, because it comes quicker.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
So that when he made the statement, I'm not a comedian, I'm Lenny Bruce, that statement was because he had stepped over a line, and in his heart of hearts, you know, a comedian should have, I think he had it timed down to, a comedian should get a laugh every 5 to 25 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
And he morphed away from being a comic, even though he was incredibly funny, and became this very hip, stylish, jazz-loving, rhythmic, prismatic, really funny guy.
When you listen to some of those concerts, like the Kieran Theater or the Bindite concert, those things, did he write those out first, or was he just making it up as he went along?
I, comics that that are critical thinkers, like Lewis Black, for instance, or Lenny Bruce, Richard Lewis. They'll have a thought, and they might write it down on a napkin, or they might put that thought on hold because the premise of the bit is going to come later. Did he sit down and type stuff out, and this is what I'm going to do tonight? Uh-uh. Did he have an idea of what he was going to talk about? Absolutely. But he never did the same show twice, never did the same act twice.
So when he sat down to write this book, I mean, did he have a co-author? Did he just decide, I'm gonna write a book, or how did that happen?
He started with working with Paul Krasner. Mm-hmm. And he was involved again with Hugh Hefner, and have published it. It started out as a periodical in 1963. Then Playboy and Playboy Press published it, and it's just a really good book. It talks about from the time that he was, a young man, a young boy, the service, meeting my mother, the very hot affair that they were having. My dad also dressed up as a priest. Yes. My mother was at one time in her life, she was a very, very, I think, very talented stripper.
Have you seen films of her performances?
Huh?
Are there films, have you seen films of her performing and so forth?
No. My mother always took great pride that she always wore a G-string and pasties. And she'd say to me, "Let me tell you something. I don't agree with all these girls spreading everything and seeing all their business up there." She said, "We wore pasties and G-strings," and just the way she would say it was so cute.
Now, your grandmother was an entertainer also. She was in burlesque, right?
Yep, she was one of the first female stand-up comics.
Sally Marr.
Yes, my grandma Sally was very funny. But she was funnier off stage.
Well, I remember her when we were kids, I remember you lived with her.
Yes.
Yeah. I have a first edition of How to Talk Dirty and Influence
People. Oh, sorry, Carrie, what?
I have a first edition right here of How to Talk Dirty and Influence People. It was $5 was the cover price.
I know. Isn't that cute? Lewis Black wrote the intro and on the reissue.
Reissue, yeah, it's great. It's wonderful.
Howard Reich, a really hip jazz critic from the Chicago Tribune. Two very talented people. And it's an easy read. It's a funny read. It's an intimate read. I was reading a part of it when he was deported from England. And they put him in a cell. He never even got into the country. He was immediately abducted. And he was jailed. They put him in the same cell as an international spy that hung himself was in, and with no regard for the fact they were acting like he had just flown from L.A. to San Francisco. He came from the States to London, and they're jailing him because he didn't even do anything yet. Who could? He did not do anything yet.
They jailed him in case he did something later?
Apparently, they didn't want him in their country. He got deported from Australia, too.
Yeah?
Oh,
and they
yeah.
have some pretty, that's a country that's all criminals, and yet they deported him.
They just didn't, for whatever reason, he was not welcome. He was not welcome. It's amazing to me that 50 years have gone by, and I will have people say to me, reading that book changed my life.
It's a very contemporary book.
I know, but if you changed your life, how could you say that? what do you mean it changed your life? And because I'm so used to my dad and just because that's what is,
it's
never
shocking.
Occurred to
it's
me
the,
that everybody
the
else didn't
it.
Think
that's
the
right.
way that we did.
That's right. The newness of it is very shocking.
Mm. And
if you haven't grown up listening to Lenny Bruce and this is your first introduction to it, it really is life changing. It's marvelous.
It amazes me that for someone who was literally just tortured, I mean, they didn't let up. The police were constantly harassing him. They were harassing my mother. They used to come up and raid the house, pull apart the toy box. I mean, it was just really unnecessary stuff.
They searched your toys, did they?
They ripped apart everything.
That's sad, Kitty.
You know, but he was in good company. There were other people that were blacklisted,
mm-hmm.
You know. And I wish that they weren't so the same.
Yeah, that things you haven't changed.
You think that in 50 years...
Things might have
that
changed more.
Would have changed.
Well, and on the one hand, they have changed in terms of what he was talking about with the power of language, because a lot of the words don't have the power that they once had because people use them all the time now.
No, I know, but it's not only that. See, he never used any sort of, I don't want to use the word curse word, or he never used words in that direction for shock value.
Mm-hmm.
It had a reason. There was a reason he was discussing what he was saying. He didn't just, you know, every other word and F this, F this, F this, F this. I put on the comedy channels and, you know, and I'll just hear just overkill. Overkill,
yes,
on swearing every other word, and I'm thinking, where are they going with this? You know, I'm waiting.
for
the, you know, the bit to end, but where are they going with this?
Without any point to it, yeah.
No, it's like they didn't realize that English is a language. You know, pick a word, baby learns a word, something. Is that?
Well, I remember a routine that Lenny Bruce did about the F word, saying that, you know, that's a word you should say to people because you love them, because effing is a marvelous thing, that he would mm-hmm. say it to his mother.
He said, unfuck you is the most horrible thing you could say to somebody.
That's great stuff. And it's still wonderful.
But fuck
stuff.
You was a nice thing, because
that's
about
love.
Making love. And, you know, I'm sure your listeners at this point, I hope I'm not offending
that's
anybody.
Okay. We'll bleep. But, you know, he also made a wonderful point about movies, where he was talking about, you know, if you have a movie where a guy comes in and he takes a pillow and he smothers a woman with it, well, that movie is fine. Anybody can see that. But if he takes mm-hmm. a pillow and shoves it under her and makes love to her, that's a movie nobody can see.
That's right.
And that's still true.
Oh, yeah. He was talking about what people were thinking back then.
And right now.
Yeah.
That's right. I'm so glad that you got the book back in print, and it's called
I Am, and the proceeds for the part that I would get go directly to the Lenny Bruce Memorial Foundation, and we're a non-for-profit charity, and what we do is we provide life-saving scholarships for men and women, young people, anybody who has an issue with drug and alcohol and needs treatment.
Well,
and
great.
So we scholarship them by paying for their treatment, their sober living, their wherever, whatever and wherever that they need help in. And it helps change lives, and it honors my father's memory in something that's doing something, you know? But if you want to find out about it, you can go to LennyBruce.org.
Well, I'm so glad you mentioned that. And it's a marvelous book, and I think so. There's a double reason for buying it, because it's great. How to Talk Dirty and Influence People, an autobiography by Lenny Bruce. And we've been chatting with my guest, his daughter, Kitty Bruce. Kitty, thank you so much for being with us on From the Bookshelf.
Oh, thank you so much, Gary. And thanks, everybody, for listening. It was nice meeting you all.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next time. In the meantime, you can check out our website at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast wherever you subscribe to podcasts. You can even get your smart speaker to play From the Bookshelf by saying, "Alexa, play Gary Shapiro's From the Bookshelf." And she will. Until next time, for From the Bookshelf, I'm Gary Shapiro. Take care. See you soon.